Indian Hills Civic Association and others versus Indian Lake Property Owners.
Good afternoon, court and counsel. Judge Parker, the trial judge, understood well the potential mischief of his decision as he was considering it at trial. From the transcript, his words, "I get the plaintiff's position. They have no certainty. When they bought their property, I suspect they had some reliance on a restriction that was in their real estate records. And if I was a seller, I'd be worried that my property values were diminished because I can't sell it because the association's passing assessments by bylaws rather than by the covenants." Now, getting down to first principles.
Well, Mr. Levy, let me interrupt you there. There were no findings of fact or conclusions of law. Is that correct?
No. He did issue his judgment.
Right. So what you quote from him, how is that of any relevance to what we're looking at, whether there is error or not?
Well, it's a matter. Our position is that, among other things, the covenants define rights, and they are intended to provide consistency and notice as to those rights. The right in particular that we're concerned about is the right to expect that no assessments will be enacted unless there is a requisite approval, which is two-thirds of the lot ownership. To get two-thirds, you need 700 votes. What respondent did instead was, on various grounds which we dispute, exercise a sense of inherent authority to do this by bylaws. And to pass a bylaw, one only needs a majority of a minority for a quorum for a bylaw, and that's approximately 350 votes, far less than even a simple majority of the ownership. We believe that the vote is an important safeguard, a fundamental safeguard. I will mention that my clients paid. We're concerned about overreach in the future. And why I mentioned they paid is because the typical case that has come before the court regarding assessments is usually there are recalcitrant owners who aren't paying their fair share. We're paying our fair share. We just want to make sure that it's done according to right, which is, in the first instance, defined by the indenture. I hope that it is responsive.
Cool. Somewhat, but I'm also a little confused. In your points, you say that the trial court misapplied or misinterpreted the law.
Yes.
What law?
Well, the law, there are several laws. There is the bylaw provision and limitations of the nonprofit corporation law, which provides in one section 197.2, a bylaw of itself cannot be a basis for member liability, including enumerated charges like assessments and dues. Of itself, would in this case, is the only thing going for this bylaw, and in our judgment, is that it was had the requisite vote, but there was nothing else behind it. Now, there is a savings clause in the statute, which says that nothing in the statute interferes with an assessment or dues or other charges imposed pursuant to an indenture. And again, our indenture provides that owners are liable for charges enacted in strict accordance with the indenture, and they are to be amendments. The amendment provision refers to the majority clause that I referenced. So that's the law. There is also some other law. There is case law that allows the courts to, in the exercise of the judicial power, to intercede and enforce equitable remedies to require recalcitrant owners to pay their fair share of the cost of critical infrastructure. The point on that is that in this case, or in all cases where that doctrine has applied, and it started with Lake Tishomingo case, and there are several other leading cases. Both parties cite them, by the way. And the conditions are, before that remedy is invoked, there has to be a defect in the covenants. There's a fundamental principle that the covenants can't be reformed. So you take the covenants as given and, in effect, fill in gaps. This was explained in the Weatherby Lake case, which stated the court needed to intervene because the developers failed to make provision for the payment of expenses through covenants or a homeowners association. So in that case, the court invoked a shared maintenance obligation. Covenant silent on assessments. Fill the gap because critical needs. In that case, the court enforced the shared maintenance obligation derived from the mutual easements shared by all owners to access common areas. In Lake Tishomingo, there was no way to amend. The lower court had reformed the covenants in excess of its jurisdiction and added an amendment provision so that the situation wasn't frozen. Well, the court couldn't write in an amendment clause. Instead, to provide funding, the court enforced an implied obligation for all owners to contribute their fair share. Now, what did our trial court do? It invented a distinction that was unknown in the covenants. It took the position that if, pursuant to the covenants, an assessment was enacted or a dues charge that in of its that was a lien on the properties in the division, then it would have to be enacted as a deed amendment pursuant to the two-thirds. But then it said, well, but the association may elect to pass an assessment as a bylaw. And in that case, well, it's okay to do that as long as it's not a lien. So he opened the door. The problem with that is the indenture says that all charges and any special assessment are liens. So he created a non-existent distinction. And there's mischief to that, because it was left to the discretion of respondent to decide if or they would impose a lien or not. I would think that if one were interested in expeditious passage of a bylaw and to avoid the need to go to the membership as a whole, one would be inclined, and that's what our concern is, to simply use bylaws as the mechanism, in effect rendering the aspect of the indenture that's of critical concern to us a non sequitur. We believe the indenture needs to be followed, and I will mention just one other quotation that I like, is that in a case involving this very respondent, the Supreme Court, our Supreme Court, said, contrary to the inherent powers argument that the trial court embraced, it said, our Supreme Court said authority for the assessments is found in restrictive covenants applicable to all property in the subdivision. Now, the meaning of that is that the authority for assessments is defined. So there's not much room for the kind of creativity in which the trial court engaged. Let's remember, this is property law. It's pretty staid. Land stands still, and revisionism is dangerous. Also, this court, in the Hellman v. Sparks decision, consistent with the prevailing view of almost all courts in the country regarding covenants, held that the terms are contractual and as such are not to be disregarded and are defined by their plain meaning and intent. Now, I reference specific language, which is pretty unambiguous. I will also mention that in addition to contract, courts of this state recognize that safeguards in an indenture are fundamental property rights that deserve protection. Now, let me, if I may, look at the plain meaning. That's the subject of our point one. The language of the indenture, various clauses, it says all of the conditions, covenants, or agreements may be changed, altered, etc., by at least two-thirds of the lot ownership. Then 9D, owners agree to all charges provided for in strict accordance, and I've mentioned strict accordance is the vote. Then 9E, all charges and any special assessments are liens. Now I would submit to you, gentlemen, words, even the most simple conjunctions or verbs or adjectives, have meaning. This is a basic point of the Supreme Court in a more recent case, the Clayton Terrace case, where quoting them down to minutia, or means or, amend means amend, and for our purposes we say any and all mean any and all. Strict accordance means two-thirds of the lot ownership to amend the terms, not a bylaw. There also, I would say, this lien distinction has never been known in these covenants since they were first enacted in 1962. And all prior enactments, a 1972 amendment, amending dues, 1983, the first special assessment, and 1989, a land use restriction, scrupulously certified that they were enacted by the requisite approval by two-thirds. This is a matter of notice. This reinforces the text of the indenture, and this notice function has been recognized as such. There was also a recorded statement by the association's president, recorded in the land records, 1984. Any special assessment must be approved by at least two-thirds of said lots, so agree in writing. Now, it may seem like a lot of votes, but we're talking about 700 out of 1,200 owners, and you can get that for an important project. It's not impossible. It's been achieved in the past. My concern is, and the record shows, and we introduced evidence to this effect, the board, when it embarked on what it called a special assessment strategy to use bylaws as a matter of convenience, knew well what the indenture provided, and they decided to disregard it. Outmoded, crippling. Now, that's not a good sentiment for us to follow because, as I say, you need a sense of stability. A lot of property law doctrines are agent. I mean, my first class in property law, we talked about livery of season. So we're talking about some staid concepts. Now, back to the statute, if I may. I'm kind of running out of time. It's a uniform law. It's been adopted in other states, and there aren't too many cases. But Wyoming, they looked at the interplay between the of itself provision and the indenture savings clause. So they looked at a water use fee that didn't have the requisite vote, and it said, finding the controlling covenants and other documents to be unambiguous and requiring two-thirds membership approval, the bylaw is void. Now, I'd like to just talk in the 2 minutes I have about remedies. These were dismissed for on substantive failure to plead grounds. One was under the MPA. Now, we rely on the Supreme Court case in Conway v. City Mortgage. And under that case, we pleaded an appropriate cause of action based on duties that persisted in plaintiff's favor with respect to this vote and became binding on defendant and plaintiffs alike during and after the sales to plaintiffs. And the court was interpreting the in connection with element of an MPA claim and says it applies to anyone who is bound by the duty, whether the cause of action arises during the transaction, before the transaction, or after. Here we had a sale. It was concluded. The deed terms are part of it. They were being violated after. We sue the respondent. Finally, actionable fraud. There is a notion that we were arguing misrepresentations of legal rights. It's been specifically held that rights and obligations of an indenture are actionable fraud, even though the covenants involve legal concepts. Another case in Mullen emphasizes the position of trust and superior knowledge as a basis of liability. Homeowners associations occupy such a position of trust and certainly know their indenture better than the members, and they can't escape responsibility for misleading characterizations. So accept our baseline of assessments being source authority, and everything we seek falls into place. Otherwise, the owners have no certainty, as Judge Parker observed. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Levy.
May it please the court. As I said, I'm sorry, Your Honor. This is my first appearance in the Southern District, as I'm usually in the Eastern District, but it's nice. This is the district I would have been in if I went to a home to where I grew up to practice law, so it's nice to finally get to come to this district. As I indicated, I'm here on behalf of Indian Lake Property Owners Association, which is made up of approximately 1,000 members in a not-for-profit corporation, which serves as essentially the homeowners association for Indian Hill Subdivision in Crawford County. The Indian Hill Subdivision is comprised of 1,800 lots. As Mr. Levy indicated, the restrictions do provide that they can be amended on a 67% vote. The bylaws of the not-for-profit association provides for amendment on 67% of those voting. There's in my brief, in the statement of facts, I went through the issues that had arisen in regards to this bridge. In the history of the subdivision, there were essentially two increases in restrictions in the assessment amount over its 50 plus year history. The first, in 1972, from reading the historical documents, apparently they had already been charging the amount and then kind of backdoored to say, okay, we're changing the restrictions, so this is the amount. The emergency special assessment, which Mr. Levy had referred to and said that the restrictions provide that any special assessment was a lien, is a little bit of a misquote of those restrictions. Those restrictions, the special assessment was over a five-year period. And within that, it said that any of those special assessments during that five-year period would be a lien. So the question really before the court is, what is the what rights does the corporation have, or what rights do the members of the corporation have to enact anything in comparison to the restrictions? We don't claim that this was a assessment via the restrictions. This was a vote of the members, which is different than a vote of the property owners, because the members only receive one vote no matter how many lots they own. So they had this situation in 2017 occur where they realized that this bridge is in danger of being overrun in the flood, which, you know, increase in rain these past few years have caused a lot of flooding in a lot of places that didn't used to have flooding. And so it turned on whether, knowing that they had trouble getting 67% of the lots to respond, let alone 67% of the lots to say yes, they looked at their avenues for potential for this emergency that they had. And under Section 355.131, the state statute provides, unless the articles of incorporation provide otherwise, the corporation has the ability to impose dues, assessments, admission, and transfer fees upon members. The articles of incorporation of the association did not state otherwise. So the members voted to do this by a two-thirds majority of those who voted, who exercised their right. And so the question is, for the court, whether or not the not-for-profit is limited in the ability to charge its members with the interplay of the restrictions, and under what circumstances they become liable. The court, in its judgment, applied the Lake Wauwinoka versus Anton case, which used the Lake Tishomingo versus Cronin case to determine the equitable obligation. Because at the time of trial, 94% of the members had paid the assessment to design the bridge, and 81%, I believe, I may have that backwards, it may be 81 and 94, I don't remember, paid the actual bridge assessment. There's no doubt that it was for infrastructure. I mean, the testimony in the statement of facts shows that this was a bridge that if it went out, essentially if it were in a flood situation and the spillway was being released, that half of the subdivision would not have a legal way out of the subdivision. And so basically it's a very simple, in my mind, question of law, not necessarily simple in its application, but simple in that, does this statute apply to a not-for-profit homeowners association, and can equitable obligation then transfer to apply liability? As to the MMPA, the court found that it failed to state a claim. The real issue is there's no doubt that my client does not sell merchandise. It doesn't. I mean, the services are just the maintenance of the subdivision, that the assessments and rules and do the rules of that. So they're not in commerce. So how does the MMPA apply? They weren't a party to any of the real estate contracts. The tie was that they have privity due to the developer sold the original lot and the developer transferred the common area. But these were not the acts, the corporation, the acts were by the members. It was a member vote. This was not the board just passing its own resolution. This was with a vote of the membership. None of the acts complained of taken had anything that were just a resolution. They were actually votes of the membership. I think the Watson versus Wells Fargo case, and even I believe this district had a criminal case that had to do with a criminal charge in the MMPA that they found that there wasn't even though they were trying to collect a fake debt, they weren't acting in commerce, so the MMPA did not apply. Thought I'd written down the citation to that, but apparently I did not.
Is it in your brief, ma'am?
I did not, Your Honor. I found
would
it.
Would you send us a letter, please? Copy to counsel, send it
sure.
to judge, or send it to.
Sure. It was a 2019 case that the Southern District.
Right, and then you may have a chance to respond if you see anything about that that needs to be responded to.
There's been some changes in the legislature that occurred after the trial but might be helpful in that the statute has changed to state under 407.025 that a court may dismiss a claim as a matter of law where the claim fails to show a likelihood that the method, act, or practice alleged to be unlawful would mislead a reasonable customer. So the act is the passage via a vote of bylaws. And whether or not that would then, I guess, keep the customer from purchasing the land, I'm not quite sure how the MMPA applies just because of the lack of commercial action by my client. The other cases shown it was a loan that had been sold, but it was still being serviced and it's still tied to the original loan. It had nothing to do with the sale of the property other than the property secured the loan. As to the fraud, Your Honors, I was not present when it was dismissed with prejudice. If the court wants to find that it should have been dismissed without prejudice, then gone. I mean, it still is that their claims are that it is a mistake of law. And if the law, the passage of the bylaws, and if they're not allowed to pass the bylaws, that's where the fraud is alleged to have occurred. So I even beat my 10 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Eaton.
Your Honors, again, let me just make one quick remark. About
Mr. Levy, if I could interrupt. I'm right by this air conditioner. If you could stand closer to the microphone,
yeah,
it would help me.
Thank you. Okay. Just one comment on the MMPA amendments. That has got to be ruled as irrelevant because specifically when the amendments were passed, it was the other cases were grandfathered. The existing cases were grandfathered, were subject to the old law. Now, as far as, the argument that was made that the 1983 amendment was actually a series of separate assessments, and so the language just applied, any of those are a charge. There's another aspect of the indenture, which is quite relevant, in that it does say all charges, it's 90, all charges, past and future, as provided for and in strict accordance with the terms and provisions hereof, are what the owners agree to pay. Again, in strict accordance, there's nothing else in here. There's nothing in here about bylaws. In strict accordance, it's a contract. Corporations have power to enter into contracts. That doesn't give them power to break them. It gives them power to make them. So yes, the association has the right to enact bylaws, but it also has limitations that curtail them. As far as this notion that it's an act of the members, well, the members' vote specifically authorized the board and the management of the association to collect and enforce. Our concern is enforcement without contract authority, contrary to the Nonprofit Act. The fact that 94% paid in the Anton case, and that's therefore, in our case, as well as the Anton case, and that therefore secures legitimacy, it begs the question. Because you first have to have the threshold situation of, at the outset, of there being a justification for an equitable solution. And as I indicated, the Weatherby case, Lake Tishomingo, which was a Supreme Court case, all indicate that basically the covenants stand unless there's a defect that needs to be corrected. And that's by the exercise of judicial power. It's not by self-help. Here the respondent engaged in self-help. Well, we don't really want to use. And that's the record will show that. It was a matter of, it's crippling, it's inconvenient. As counsel said, well, it's hard to get 2/3 vote. Okay, let's not bother. Let's just go and pass a bylaw. It's much easier, and we can just do that. And it opens the door, as I indicated, to a flood of assessments. We don't mind paying assessments. We don't mind the board putting them out for a vote. We think that a consensus needs to be built according to our contract. Now, suppose it's critical and they can't possibly get the vote, but the dam is going to be breached and they need to spend $1 million. Okay, that's not the case here because they didn't even try. They can't say, well, we didn't get the votes. They've gotten the votes in the past, the 2/3. It's just that it's too daunting, not convenient. Let's just try something else and call it a special assessment strategy. That's our concern. Now, if we reach the other situation, we may be back here, but at the very least, judicial intervention should be sought. It shouldn't be presumed as, well, all the other cases that provide the exception, somebody got court approval, but we'll just assume approval. We'll define our own sense of equity. We'll define a new majority. That just is not correct. Contracts are made to be pacta sunt servanda. It's pretty fundamental. And we're dealing, as I say, with contract, statutory limitations, and property rights. Our right to get the right correct level of approval is a property right, just as we have a right to keep trespassers off physically. So I think I have covered it, and I only have 5 seconds, so I will use that time. Justice Jackson said, you'll know when to sit down. I'm going to follow his advice. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Levy.